the mindset is very different when you when you're building to sell, when your product is essentially the company. You've already, you know, that's what they call the exit, right? You give the 5 or 20 minute spiel to the venture capitalists, and it's all about how are we going to exit this. And so your whole notion is you're not treating the business as a being on its own journey. You're treating it as an asset that's being bought and sold. And I think that mindset, you know, brings a very, very narrow focus, which can be very liberating in some ways, because you're just all here to go get the same thing done. But I think it takes the humanity out of it many times, and you end up with really horrible types of situations like a WeWork and a, you know, an Uber, where they're just bulldozing over people. They're megalomaniacs. It's just this horrible thing. I mean, that's sort of where that model goes to die.
This time, our friend Bijoy Goswami returns to the Plutopia podcast. We explore bootstrapping your business versus venture capital funding, the human journey and the American journey, the great replacement theory, capitalism and greed, socialism, and religion as a product.
Well, we should introduce Bijoy. Bijoy is a fairly interesting person, having grown up in the East and the West. He was born in India, moved to Taiwan when he was 10, Hong Kong when he was 14, came to the U.S. in 1991 to attend Stanford University, where he studied computer science, economics, and history, and completed an honors program in science, technology, and society. And Bijoy and I have been friends for a long time. And we were, what would you call us? We were like conspirators in the bootstrap.
That's right, collaborators, contributors.
Yeah.
Stewards.
And that was, when did Bootstrap start?
Bastille Day 2003, July 14th, 2003.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess that was a long time ago, wasn't it?
It's crazy.
So explain Bootstrap so that people will know what we're talking about.
Bootstrapping, or bootstrap the community, I guess, or maybe you guess you need both. Bootstrapping is a method of entrepreneurial activity that's complementary to, but different from, the funding driven method, which is what gets a lot of attention and, you know, has a lot of the takes up a lot of the oxygen in the room with Silicon Valley and whatnot. But bootstrapping actually is at the heart of Silicon Valley's history, and I got interested in it way back at school. And then when I was bootstrapping my own company and people can get funding for their ventures in the early 2000s, post 9/11, post, you know, dot-com bust, I started gathering these folks together. And well, I just thought it was a one-off meeting at the Gingerman pub. And I was very pleased with myself, because I thought I was going to save a lot of time from these one-on-one meetings I was having with other entrepreneurs. And you know, they couldn't get funding. I said, you should bootstrap it. That's the way the great companies got built, you know. And then I thought, I'll just introduce them and be done. And then it was, no, when's the next meeting? And then it was, when's the next meeting? We'd like to hear from some successful bootstrappers. And so then I didn't realize I was in the middle of building a community. And I learned how to turn the community building to the fellow community members, because I didn't want to, you know, do more work. And so then when they had ideas, I would say, why don't you take that on? That'd be great. And so that's kind of this organism that we became part of, all of us. And each of us took on various roles of leadership and community. We could step in, we could step out. It was just a really great community. It was one of the early communities for entrepreneurship in Austin, along with like the Rice Alliance, I think, had their first founding meeting. They were on the same month or the same year, and a few others, when we didn't really have an entrepreneur scene. And it became a wonderful place for all of us to grow, to learn, to hear from successful bootstrappers, to support each other, share our knowledge, our connections, our insights with each other. I'd say it was a really special, you know, one gets nostalgic about such things, but I think it was a very special place.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a philosophy of business that is very common now. It's the kind of thing that people who get MBAs learn to practice. And it's that the idea is that you build a business to sell it, you know, that you build a business to exit in some way. And I always thought that we should pay more than lip service to the idea of building a business because you love the idea of the business. And because you really want to have the business and build it yourself and maybe hold it for a while, which is, I think, was much more common, you know, before businesses started being produced like factory products. And bootstrap, you know, was one way to think about doing that, is that you bootstrap your business, but it may be that you intend to sell it at some point, or it could be that you intend to hold on to it. But I think the bootstrap thinking was a little friendlier to the idea of, you know, having a business because it's your passion to have that business.
Absolutely. And, you know, the mindset is very different when you, when you're building to sell, when your product is essentially the company, you've already, you know, that's what they call the exit, right? You give the, 5 or 20 minute spiel to the venture capitalists, and it's all about how are we going to exit this? And so your whole notion is you're not treating the business as a being on its own journey. You're treating it as an asset that's being bought and sold. And I think that mindset, you know, brings a very, very narrow focus, which can be very liberating in some ways, because you're just all here to go get the same thing done. But I think it takes the humanity out of it many times. And you end up with really horrible types of situations, like a WeWork and a, you know, an Uber, where they're just bulldozing over people. They're megalomaniacs. It's just this horrible thing. I mean, that's sort of where that model goes to die and express its full completion. And I think there's just a lot to be. Yeah, I remember when Steve Jobs back in the day said, as people were exiting these silly dot-com businesses and making millions of dollars. And he just said, you know, I feel like you're missing out. You're missing out on the journey where Woz and I went. He had to sell his computer, and I had to sell my VW bug or van. And then we had to pull that money, and then we had to go find some customers and get some part. Like, he's like, you know, you're not really building a business, and you're skipping all these steps to the exit. Right. And so, yeah, I think fundamentally, I think that was why I was interested in bootstrapping, even though I was in the heart of Silicon Valley. It was all about venture capital and all of that. But I was very attracted to bootstrapping because I think fundamentally I am interested in stewardship of beings on our journeys, you know, and how do we have this wonderful experience of life? And it's all too short, you know, as time flies for all of us. And it's sort of like these outcomes matter not very much in the end, but the process, the journey, the who you meet along the way, how you treat people, how you are treated, the fun you have. I think that's so much more important. It's very hard to convince somebody who hasn't lived much that that's really important. But as you've lived more time, you start to realize that that is what life is. It's a set of series of moments and instances that either contain joy or they contain suffering and strife and, you know, all of those things. So I think, yeah, it was interesting for me in retrospect. I was always a bootstrapper because I fundamentally believe that was the right way to raise the kid, you know, that was the journey I wanted to be on. Whereas I think a lot of folks maybe who were part of Bootstrap Austin were bootstrappers because they tried to go the funding route and they couldn't get funding because that was the glamorous way that everybody's been sold and told they're supposed to start a company. And then they ended up bootstrapping. And of which many of them built some incredibly awesome businesses, successful. Some of them are still running their businesses. Some of them sold their businesses and had a great time doing it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there was a fairly high failure rate, I know. But I think you have that high failure rate in all business. You know, it's hard to really get that ball over the line. But regardless of whether the people who were engaged in the Bootstrap Network, whether they failed or succeeded in the business they were trying to bootstrap, they learned so much. I mean, there was so much exchange of knowledge within that group of people. And mm-hmm. I know I was kind of, I was a person who had been around for, you know, a number of years doing a number of things where I really wasn't attempting to build or run a business. In other words, I was not an entrepreneur. And then I decided that I was interested in doing a business. I had a kind of business in mind. So when I engaged with Bootstrap, I didn't know a lot about business, and it was a real crash course. You know, I learned mm-hmm. a lot, and I learned it pretty quickly. And part of that was just through sharing with people. You know, like one thing I remember is the Valley of Death groups that we had. You yes. know, people who had their business was in the Valley of Death, as we called it. And the group that I was involved with had maybe 4, 5, 6 people in it.
Oh, the boot board that you had, the specific boot board of group that, yeah, would meet once a month.
Yeah. And it was a really diverse set of people doing really different things, but learning a lot from each other.
When John and I started Plutopia News Network, I don't think we were so much thinking about bootstrapping. We just knew that we enjoyed doing this thing that we do, and we knew there was no golden parachute that's going to be strapped to us. We're not going to get any big fortune out of this, but we enjoy the process of talking to people and learning about what's going on out in the world. And that's an important part of doing things, is if you don't get something out of it that means something to you inside, then you're just wasting your time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've been using this term journey entrepreneurship, you know, where you're on this journey and you're connecting it, you know. A purely economically driven entrepreneur doesn't care what they're doing, as long as they can sell a lot of it and sell the company and make their money. They wouldn't care whether they were making beer or selling software or, you know, doing a podcast. But when you're on that journey and you're connecting that journey personally to this venture, you're extending your own journey, and that matters so much more. And I think that's the hard thing to me. It was always interesting, because it was like, when you talk about entrepreneurship, there was this default consideration that you were supposed to take this one path. And for me, that was always why I was an advocate of bootstrapping and became such, is because I didn't want to have people take a decision blindly. It's not that venture capital is some sort of bad path. It's its own path. It has its own rewards. It has its own beautiful things that it's created, great companies that have come out of that journey, and certain things that really need a ton of venture capital to succeed. It was just that people were blindly considering that without considering the trade-offs and who they were, where they were on their journey, and maybe even where their venture was on its journey, right? There's a lot of ventures that when they're bootstrapped initially, they actually get to this place where they stumble into and they figure out their business model. And that's a great time to get connected with VCs who say, look, we've got all the capital to go scale that business model up. And that's, to me, that what unifies both the bootstrapping and the venture, is that they're in search of new business models, right? They're both methods that are trying to discover new novel business models that haven't existed. And they're just taking a different path, but it's not that they just occur mutually exclusively either, because you can bolt on a funding, process to your bootstrap venture, which I've also seen many of my friends and entrepreneurs do, who then like take that to then, you know, scale out a business. Maybe at that point, you've got this really great thing that does need to be everywhere. And, you know, you've mastered it in your local domain, and now it's time to take it away. Okay, great. That's a great time to, I think, employ venture capital. Versus the earlier and earlier that you employ that, the less control you have, the more time is of essence, right? The constraint in venture capital is time, because you're sitting inside of a venture capital fund, which has a lifespan of 10 to 12 years. And that time clock has started, and they need to either return the money and be done with those investments by 12 years. And so immediately you're in this arbitrary time constraint, whereas it might take you 3, 4, 5, 6 years. I mean, you know, Southwest Airlines, 4 years, no airline from 1967 to 71, whatever that is, because they went into a legal battle for the mere right to exist. And they just soldiered on for 4 years, you know, with this company that wasn't flying a single plane. I mean, so that took 4 years, but the venture capitalists would be like, we're done. Like, we haven't done it. So let's go. Right. So there's this interesting set of trade-offs, and time is one of those things that's really at play here, is this bootstrap and journey sort of approach. You're giving yourself a lot of time. You're unconstraining time. You're making sure your resource constraints are low. You kind of hunker down and you make sure you can have a long runway so that you can spend a lot of time. In the VC, you have unconstrained resources, but you have extremely constrained time. And that isn't, you know, those timing things are weird because things take time. Sometimes it takes time for the market to catch up to your idea. And sometimes the VC would have already moved on to the next big thing because you didn't have that time to go and cultivate and develop something.
Yeah, and it's kind of powerful to go through that experience of really having to, it's sort of like having to work without much oxygen, you know, having to try to build your business with very little by way of funding, versus being like maybe early on overcapitalized and wasting the money. You know, I mean, I've seen companies that would blow through money. I've seen situations where you'd go into a new business and they've spent tons of money. Actually, the WeWork thing, there was a lot about that.
Oh my God.
I watched that whole series about that and kind of studied what had happened with that company. And, you know, they were wasteful and they kept convincing themselves that this is the way that you build a business, is that you build it by, you know, spending. But they were not spending in the right way. And even though at times they had the right attitude about things, they couldn't sustain it very well. They couldn't sustain the right attitude, and they couldn't sustain the business ultimately.
Well, there are a lot of businesses that went to the venture capital route and suffered greatly. Anyone remember Sears Roebuck and Company? They're not around anymore. They were basically murdered by their capitalization. I mean, it just became unsustainable. And that was my first job out of college. When I graduated from the University of North Texas, I went to work for the regional headquarters of Sears Roebuck and Company. And I bailed pretty quickly because they were already in a death spiral. And this was in the the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And there are so many other companies you can see that went that same way. They said, oh boy, we've got all this money, let's go. And all of a sudden, somebody says the debt is due. And suddenly your company is no longer your company. It belongs to the guys who gave you the big bucks.
Pulling of the plug. So Bijoy, you have a number of things that are sort of frameworks or, you know, sort of philosophical approaches that you have worked through over the years. How did those relate to the Bootstrap network?
Well, I think the Bootstrap network and that community sent me on my journey, you know, in a way that I was being very cookie cutter I was sort of thinking in a mold of a certain kind of entrepreneurial archetype, you know, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, whatever that was back at the time. And then Bootstrap and Austin specifically got me to ask the question, well, what is Bejoy's journey? Not what is Bejoy's journey as channeled by tech entrepreneur at the time. And I think through that, and then being in Austin and then being in this very supportive community, I started doing things that I didn't expect to do, that I wasn't thinking to do. Even writing The Human Fabric as a book was not something that was in my purview. I just didn't think, you know, why would I write a book? I'm a tech person, you know? So what was, I think, very limited in my narrow blinders got opened. My perspective got opened, and I started really connecting to my own journey and what my journey had given me. And then slowly started to listen to the universe, you know, hey, what about this? What about that? And it took me down this journey of saying that, you know, what I'm fundamentally interested in is models, frameworks, how we approach things, and that sort of we run on a set of software. All of us are programmed, right? We have a set of hardware, and then you know, nature gives us some programming, and then parents and society program, you know, install a bunch of software. It takes about 18, 20 years, maybe longer, 22, 24. And then we kind of, out here we are, we're out running the world with these models and software that we've been programmed on. But I couldn't just take the software that I was given for granted, because I got conflicting software. You know, I got a Catholic mother and then a Hindu father. So that was two very different spiritual programs or models for how the world works and what salvation is and what, you know, the afterlife, whatever that is. So I couldn't just say, well, wow, cool. Where's a lot of people who grew up in one particular society, one particular town, one particular, you just get that, you get programmed in a certain way, right? And so I think I've always been interested in this notion of how do we steward our own journeys? How do I bejoy? You know, because that was a question I had to ask myself. I had to ask myself, what's my accent? Because I was, you know, from an Indian family, but going to an American school, living in a Chinese society. I mean, I could do all the accents. Well, what's my accent? I mean, how many people have to think about their own accent? Well, I had to decide what accent I was comfortable having, and then, you know, in, you know, going with that, right? So I think these are, like, for me, it's always interesting to look at how we absorb frameworks, ideas, knowledge, and I think there's a gap. There's certain gaps in the way that we organize society for lots of different reasons that don't give us certain things that I think are very essential to understanding ourselves, understanding how the world works, where we are today. And for me, it was very lucky because one of the things I did was I spent a lot of time in history. One of my courses of study at school was history. And that just gives you an appreciation for, you know, the world today is not, it didn't just come here magically. It came here through a series of events. And where was that? And what caused that? So, you know, with bootstrapping, it was, hey, there's a path of entrepreneurship that no one's talking about. Yet here it is. And so many of these successful entrepreneurs who, you know, continue to helm their companies, they bootstrapped it, but no one's talking about it because everybody's talking about this other approach. And I think the other impulse that I have is a kind of democratic impulse. It's that I feel like I'm a child of a lot of privilege. Not the sort of privilege that people think about, like, oh, you grew up with a lot of money. No, but privilege in the sense of who my parents were and the love that I got, the unconditional love, the way they raised me and my brothers, the places we got to live. You know, yes, it's dislocating to live in three countries as a kid, but it's amazingly eye-opening to have those things installed in you, different languages, different religions, different cultures. And you just come out with a different perspective of the human journey. It's really the human journey, not the American journey or the Indian journey or the Chinese journey. You come up with a very different perspective. And I think we're on this spaceship Earth, as our dear friend Buckminster Fuller said, right? And how do we progress? How do we live together? How do we work together? How do we fulfill our dreams? You know, these are the questions that to me are the most interesting ones and have led me down various paths that have created a lot of joy for me. And then hopefully when I've been able to package or to share those models, because I was not really somebody that was like thinking I should share anything with other people in this sense. I had a friend tell me I should write a book about this MRE framework, the model about people. But really that came out of the software company, and I was not really interested. Like, why would I write a book? There's other sources here, so on and so forth. But then someone said, yeah, it was actually Betty Sue Flowers from the LBJ Library.
Oh yeah.
Wonderful Betty Sue. I was meeting with her at the LBJ Library, and I said, Betty Sue, you know, I've got friends telling me I should write a book, but I'm really referencing a lot of research and ideas and frameworks that are already there, and this is my list. And she goes, but Joy, it's not necessarily that people need to hear new ideas. They might need to hear old ideas communicated in a new way. And I said, oh,
that was smart.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. That's like, okay, I can do, you know, that's fun. And I can now contextualize things for our situation. So, and for example, just that idea of like understanding that people are wired differently, right? We all walk around with this golden rule notion. We're all the same, treat everybody that you want to be treated. Well, no, right? At some level, it's true. We are all the same. We're human beings. But at another level, we're not the same. And if we walk around treating others like they should be like us, then we miss a lot. We miss a lot about what are the complementary things people can bring to our worlds? What are my unique strengths? What are my weaknesses? Right. And how do I put this all together? So for me, it was extremely revelatory to have a framework that allowed me to understand myself, understand how others were different, and then be able to relate differently to myself and to others.
It's making me think about the kind of, you know, the Buddhist paradox about how we are all one, but we are all different. You know,
yeah.
It's like everybody is connected. Everything is connected, but everything is also different, and both can be true.
And both are really powerful, right? I mean, again, these dualities that we get into, our mind loves dualities. It's one of the kind of like, I think one of the really bad features, like the bugs in the human mind. It loves dualities, and then it lives in an either or, you know, black or white, you know, red or blue, right? These kinds of dualities that are really arbitrary models that we've constructed to understand the world. But even from the duality, like I spent a lot of time looking at the yin yang as a model, as a construct. And I started looking at it as a flow diagram. You know, like what happens when it's not a static symbol, but actually a flow diagram of movement. And then you realize, oh, I'm exploring a duality. I'm exploring one side of something. I'm going to the other side of that thing. And then I come into the center and find out how both of these reinforce each other, right? That takes a different kind of mind to be able to see the two sides of a particular equation or multiple sides from an equation. But that's a training. That's a mind that has to be trained. It doesn't come out that way. It doesn't show up that way from basic kind of, you know, tribal upbringing or whatnot. And so, like, I think we're missing a lot of training of human beings to be human beings and to enjoy their lives and be part of this process. And then we're getting kind of a lot of, you know, challenges that we face, right, as a society and so on and so forth. And it's not unique to America. Like, the problems in America are not unique to America. You know, people love to say the exceptionalism of America. Well, there's nothing that exceptional about America's problems. These have been like age-old problems that humans have dealt with.
Yeah, human problems.
Solutions. They're human problems, you know. And every civilization has had an incredible moment in the sun where they've been the great civilization. They figured certain things out. Then they lost their way, and then another civilization took over. And that's the march of history. But if you don't know history, you won't know that. You know, you don't know that's where things are, or that America's journey is really a tiny little journey. Like, it's a few hundred years. You know, the civilizations of the world are thousands of years old, right? It doesn't make anyone better or worse. I mean, there's a lot to that I love about America, being American and living in this country, that makes me really, I love the precocious child that America is, right? It's like your teenage son that's like in advanced AP calculus, you know, and it's like, hey, look what I can do. And it's like, yeah, you're really good, man. Good job, kid. Like, keep going. But, you know, understand that you don't know everything, and there's a lot more that you don't know that you do know. And let's appreciate that you're actually sitting on top of a lot of civilizations that have done a lot of work and people for you to get to where you are, right?
But what do you think about all the craziness and polarization that we have right now in the USA?
I think that as a person who came to this country, as you said, in the 90s and studied my history, like, you know, I did American history, I didn't appreciate the depth of which the original sin, if you like, of America, slavery, and the racism, the intrinsic racism of that. I did not grow up in a racist, I mean, environment. And what I mean by that is that I never had to think about whether my friends were white or black or brown. Or I lived in an international community. I was a super minority. You know, in Taiwan, we were 0.0001% of the majority Taiwanese, Chinese folks that live there. But my school was multinational, you know. So for me, like, this idea of diversity wasn't something I had to be taught. I lived in a diverse place. I had different people that were that had different perspectives and histories and whatever. But like in the States, this journey of slavery, and then that the problems that caused, and then, you know, even the Civil War didn't resolve those issues. There were many,
obviously
many people,
not, yeah.
Right, who are still fighting. And so I think it's really interesting because You have this really weird phenomena of aggrieved majorities. You have this in a place like India. You have Hindu nationalism in India, where people who are Hindus, the dominant population, is aggrieved against Muslims who are, you know, a minority population, or Christians or others. And they want to make it it's a Hindu country. Well, no, it isn't, right? Or that's a discussion. So in America, this sort of ongoing journey of, like, you know, you had Reconstruction and then you had the Jim Crow, right? You always have this progress, but then the fight back and the progress and the fight back. You have the civil rights movement and the repercussions back there. You had Obama and you get that. So I think a lot of what is going on that I think I appreciated really deeply during the Black Lives Matter things and studying going back there, it's like that issue is still very, very deeply embedded. And we're still trying to get all that poison out of the American body politic that is still caught up in these conversations that are very limiting and very, you know, reductive and things like that. And so I think there's that piece of what I call the white lash that America is still going through. But part of what I think is interesting is that the white lash is the result of an equalizing society. It's only when the society is becoming more equal that the original folks that had sort of a dominant place in the society are feeling like things are getting worse for me. Because, well, you have to participate just like everybody else. You got to fight for that job just like everybody else. It's an equalizing society that causes a dominant person to say, oh, wait, where's my place in that? And so I think, like, there's that challenge is the default set of folks who have been, you know, we're America, right? They're like, wait, no, America's not white people. America's not brown people. America's a concept of a whole bunch of other ideas.
A melting pot.
But there's two things between America's professed ideals and what it says about itself and what its reality is, you know. And that's where I think we've just gotten back to reality about, hey, where are we really on this journey? And, oh, we're here, not here. And we got to work out these things. We got to talk about why is a monument of some Civil War general who was a traitor to this country, why is that monument up on a place to dehumanize people who were trampled by that kind of event? And I'm talking about the white people too, right? The those kinds of things, those kinds of concepts are as dehumanizing to the dominant person as they are to the minority. So, like, I think that part of where a lot of what's happening to me as kind of an outside observer, I'm an insider, but I'm an outsider. It's kind of been one of my personal gifts in my life, is that I underestimated, and this has become quite clear, that we're dealing with this white lash and we still have a long way to go to do that. Now, are we the same place we were 20 years ago? Are we in the same place we were 50 years ago, 100 years ago? Oh my gosh, no, right? You look at those moments, you're like, I'll take the mess we're in today for the any of the other messes that we were in before, because those realities were much worse for everybody, certainly for a person like myself. So I think there's that. I think that's kind of a very constraining model of, like, who we are, what our identity is, using color and race as a way to identify ourselves, I think is a very limiting kind of concept. It's a part of who I am, but it's not who I am, right? It's like gender. Is it the fact that I'm male or female, like we were having the gender attributions, right? That's a whole, whatever that is, a spectrum, it's a set of, but is that entirely who you are? Gosh, no, it's not. That's one part of who I am. Is my spirituality all of who I am? Is my sexual preference? These are all aspects of who we are. We're many selves, you know, inside of a human being. But what happens if you just take one and just go kind of like, you run with it and make that your entire identity, then anything that threatens or challenges that is going to be problematic for you.
The whole movement for equality and civil rights has generated an opposite movement who talks about the great replacement theory. What is your take on great replacement? Where did that come from?
And it's incredibly silly. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. No one's trying to replace anybody, you know. But again, it's I think in the absence of something that you have meaningful in your life, in the absence of real connection to your journey, real opportunity, real invitation to go on this journey and have fun with it, you know, you can start to see things as very limited ways. And I think people a lot of prey. So I think what I didn't also underestimate is hate capitalism. We have a country full of hate capitalists. They make money and prey on people by stoking their fear. You know, no matter how evolved you get in life, you can't get rid of that little primal brain that's sitting there, right? If I come at you with my arms, like, you'll react and you might like punch me or something like that. We have the primal brain. Continue. We have to deal with that primal brain. We can't get rid of it. But that primal brain can be hijacked. And that's what things like Fox News does. Fox News is and all of its, you know, its ilk, its spawn. If you look at the history of Fox News, I mean, Fox News was first supposed to be just a competitor to CNN when Rupert Murdoch was trying to do that. And it was this guy, Roger Ailes, who said, no, you've got to give these people what they want to hear and no one's speaking to them. Well, yeah, feeding people the garbage that they want to hear is not a good thing. That's going to just make them more ignorant. But that's what Fox News is. It's a hate capitalist enterprise. It wants to divide people. It wants to stoke fear. Oh, Christmas is being destroyed. Oh, you know, your rights to be taken away. So people, you know, in that world are in this defensive crouch because they have been instigated into that kind of mindset, you know. And you can make money on that, right? You know, Alex Jones spews his garbage and says blah blah blah. He says, this vitamin will save you from the garbage I'm spewing. So he sets up the fear and then he provides a solution to that fear. So people can be hijacked. America is also very hijacked by capitalism. And what's interesting about that is because we are the best practitioner of capitalism, we are the best creator of entrepreneurship, and it's amazing, right? But we also then over-rely on that hammer, that tool, to solve all our problems. We think capitalism can solve every problem. No, it doesn't solve every problem. There's a role for government. There's a role for science. There's a role for all these things. So the same thing happens. It's like, oh, there's an entrepreneur coming here selling me some snake oil. I'm going to buy some of that, right? The solution to all my problems is to a product I can sell, buy or sell. So I think there's certain blind spots in the American psyche, which are also just human things that are then leveraged by a bunch of people who make money based on stoking fear.
Yeah. I mean, there is good that comes from capitalism, obviously, but greed is a problem. And as greed grows, and it will, you know, unless there's some mechanism to constrain it, then capitalism can become toxic. It's sort of like, you know, if you drink a mixed drink, you're kind of okay. But if you down a whole bottle of booze, then you're going to be really, really sick and maybe die. You know, it's toxic. It's poison. But it's poison. Yeah. The poison is related to the dose.
And the overexpression of any one thing leads to the dark side of that thing, right? Whether it's an energy a person has that they overexpress in the wrong situation, or a tool like capitalism or entrepreneurship. I mean, what I think is genius about capitalism and why I'm a capitalist and I'm a supporter of entrepreneurship of all kinds, including venture capital and bootstrapping, is because it takes that human impulse, which the way we got resources before, we just took it from each other. I want more stuff. I'm going to grab your stuff, right? I'm going to come with an army and grab your stuff. Well, that's not a very good way to do it. And so what capitalism did was a genius of understanding human nature and saying, we are greedy, but let's put that greed to productive use. Instead of taking your stuff, what happens if I make something you need? And if I solve a problem that you have, I can accumulate stuff because I've earned it rightfully. I've traded it with you. I've given you something you value. That's the absolute genius of what capitalism is and entrepreneurship, which is the engine inside capitalism. So that's, to me, like, we should not be going away from capitalism. Like, you know, I grew up in state-run economies. My first childhood, my childhood in India was in a socialist country. And I don't mean socialist the way people here don't actually understand the terms they're even using here, where they talk socialism. Like, no, it's socialist is where the government runs the actual economy, versus when we talk about socialism, we talk about certain things that have to be provided by the government. But I don't think any of us are saying, or any of us should be saying, that we want a government-run economy. That is an absolute unmitigated disaster and nightmare, because all it does is concentrate the power of production in the hands of a very few people. Government bureaucrats or politicians who control that government enterprise. So you want this decentralized beauty that capitalism is, and everybody offers their products in an open marketplace. That's one of the greatest inventions of what I consider to be the three or four greatest inventions of humankind, is this process of entrepreneurship. But again, like anything else, it has a boundary. It doesn't solve all problems, right?
Some things work better if they're socialized, but you don't have to become a socialist society to have some socialist aspects or some things socialized, you know, like socialized medicine or socialized transportation, highways, whatever. It makes sense.
Exactly. And I think that, again, it's for lack of having the right frameworks and models and mental concepts that people get into trouble. They simplify and then things become, you know, they get into arguments about all the wrong things. So let's just look at that. Like there basically is a need for resources that we have. It's a domain of human existence, resources. But we have this domain called rights. We have to figure out what rights we collectively are going to live under. Those are two separate domains. They're related, but they're separate. And when something becomes a right, it needs to be entrusted not to the free market, but to the place that where the rights are guaranteed, to the government. The government is the keeper of the rights. Now, as a society evolves, more things become rights. So we didn't think 50 years ago that everybody has the right to healthcare. We didn't think 50 years ago that everybody has a right to a lot of things, but we did say, for example, think everybody has a right to a road. Rich people shouldn't have a road and poor people shouldn't not have a road. So once something becomes a right, it is something that falls into this house of rights. It moves out of the house of resources. And the house of resources, hey, you can buy the $500 Gucci, I can buy the $20 bag. It's okay. No big deal. You're paying more for it because you're buying into whatever that brand represents. I think that's a waste of money. I go buy my cheap brand off Amazon. We're both happy. There's no problem there. When it comes to a right, when it comes to something we all agree societally that we should have, we can't leave that capitalism, because capitalism is going to do this differentiation thing and say, hey, I'm going to make this road better because the rich people can pay for a better road. So there's, once things move into a domain of rights, they belong for the government to take charge of. And that's where people are getting kind of confused, right? It's in Europe, for example, kings ran things for thousands of years. So that second house of rights dominated. You didn't have an economy. You had the kings that would do all that, ran the economy, owned the economy, and dominate everything. So even with those places when capitalism took its rightful place and kings got rid of and they became democracies, they still looked to that second house of rights to solve a lot of their problems. Now, in their case, sometimes maybe too much, right? But in certain issues, like let's say healthcare, they're much further along than we are, because they know that everybody, to have a society, you need a basic level of healthcare that everybody needs to have. It's a basic right. So whereas in America, we're like, we'll just pay for the healthcare that you want. Well, that's not going to work during COVID, as we learned. If somebody is sick, we're all sick. If we don't take care of the whole population, everybody's in danger. So that's the confusion that, for example, America's bias toward capitalism and entrepreneurship to solve its problems leaves it laggard in using the government and the House of Rights to solve certain things and ensure that things that should be given to everybody are given, a base level of X, Y, or Z.
There are some people in this country who feel that their right to their freedom of religion, to worship their whatever, is being infringed upon. And in fact, religion has been hijacked in many places in this country by people that have no real interest in religion. It's become a political movement rather than a religious movement. How did we get to that point?
Well, two things there. So number one, again, pastors in America are capitalists. Let's understand that, right? Religion operates in America as an entrepreneurial venture. You got to fight for these folks to come to your church and not the other church. And so it's become an entrepreneurial game. In an entrepreneur, what does an entrepreneur do? You got to differentiate your product. You got to talk about my version of Jesus's answer versus someone else's version. And you got all these different churches and prosperity churches and this church and that church. So that's not how religion has worked for a long time in other places. Like there's a doctrinal thing and they go, this is what this great prophet or whatever said. And we're all just trying to understand that. That's not American, like Christianity is a very interesting like version of Christianity that's very different from Christianity in Europe or other places, right? So I think that's, again, one of the things is that when your pastor is an entrepreneur trying to make money, they're motivated by selling you a product that you're going to like. So that's, I think, one issue. Now, the second issue is with the House of Rights, all rights are in competition with each other. That's the nature of working through that house. It's why debate is such an important, the form of speech in the House of Rights is debate, right? Hey, I'm for this motion. I'm against this motion. We should have this thing. We should not have who ayes and the nays. That's the nature of communication there, because we have to talk about, does this entity have more rights than this entity, right? Does the state have more rights than the individual, or the company have more rights than the city, or whatever those are? So it's all competing rights. Now, religion is interesting because it fits into this fourth house of meaning. Religion is a part of this fourth house of meaning, where we all get to, and we should be able to, decide our relationship to the cosmos and our kind of understanding or our model for how should we relate to the universe, right? And that's what religion fundamentally at its core solves that problem. In fact, religion has always helped us with all of these houses. That's so what's so interesting about religion. It's carried a lot of weight for humans for thousands and thousands of years to help us organize our society, to tell us what our laws should be, you know, the Ten Commandments, right? The code of whatever, right? The religion has supplied all those things, the meaning of life, who God is, how the world works. Religion told us about what the sun was. It was the sun god rising in the west. As we invented and cleaved these other houses through the scientific method, for example, right? A lot of us don't use a 2,000-year-old book written by pre-scientific people to tell us how old the earth is. But that's because we took back from religion a thing that it never should have had the purview of. Religion is not about telling me how the world works. It has no tools or methods to help me discover how the world works. Science and the scientific method, it absolutely does, right? And that's only about 300 years old. The scientific method is only about 300 years old. So we have this interesting thing where some models of how we understand the world, like how old the world is, come from really old places. But yet we have science that's continuing to study the earth and say, no, actually it's whatever billion years old. But now what's a human being to do? I got one thing saying this book that I believe in and supposed to get me to heaven is telling me the earth is this old. And then I've got this thing called science, which I might not understand or might not have been taught in school. So how do I evaluate whether the science answer is correct or this answer is correct? We've got this new bacteria virus coming through. Do I believe that guy on YouTube telling me that I can, you know, get his special tonic? Or do I believe the scientist who says, here's the research we've been doing for 200 years on viruses? So as a human being, it's a really complicated place. I don't think I'm answering your question quite directly, but what I'm saying is that...
Well, you're getting to the question of authority.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
I think is an important question.
Right. So the point of like your personally held beliefs or your personal models, okay, is what I call this house of meaning. We all get to run... Like, I can sit here and tell you, John, you know, Scoop, you guys are wrong. The sky is made of stars, you know, or it's made of, you know, Coke bottles. And I can run with that. No one's going to ultimately be able to convince me if I don't decide to be convinced that the sky is made out of Coke bottles. We all get to hold arbitrary and ridiculous beliefs. And you know what? Humans have held completely ridiculous beliefs for the longest time. And that includes our belief about the cosmos and God and all of that. That's just a very complex question. Science doesn't really have good answers for that. It doesn't tell you whether a being has intelligently designed the universe. So you kind of have to decide that for yourself and then figure out like, okay, if the being designed the universe, does the being care about what I do? And so that's the thing. Now, in the House of Rights, your arbitrary beliefs, if enough of us hold an arbitrary belief, then we might use that House of Rights to say, well, this is a law based on this arbitrary belief, right? So all of our personal meanings are aggregating into the House of Rights, where we say yay or nay to a law that says we have this right or not. So on the one hand, we do have a fundamental right to our own religion, our own meaning belief system, but we don't have a fundamental right to that if it's going to intrude on enough of us that say, wait a second, we don't agree with that, right? So the democratic solution to the rights problem is that we all get to participate in the rights-making process. the pre-authority, as you were pointing out, John, system was the king, the church, whoever's in charge just gets to just make up the laws arbitrarily, right? And what we replaced that with, in the same way we replaced the scientific method with, sorry, the authority-based, you know, science with scientific method, we replaced a monarch-based rights-making system to a process. Now, necessarily, that means that you and I are never going to agree on every single law, right? If I were the great king, I'd have certain laws, but I don't get to be the great king. We all have to make these laws together. So in any one moment in time, we will disagree on which law is correct or not. And this process will not necessarily provide perfect answers either, right? And so we have to keep doing the process over and over again to establish things. What's interesting about the Rights House is that we've certainly understood that there are certain fundamental rights, and those keep growing. And as we kind of come back and re-litigate a right, we kind of realize, okay, this is where that sits. For various reasons, America has certain things where it has really blind spots, like guns, super big blind spot about guns. Women's rights, you know, that's a long journey about women's rights to their bodies. So there's certain things which are taking longer. But ultimately, if you look at the overall march of progress, these rights are being ultimately enshrined. They're being adopted, you know, into the fabric of the society.
Yeah, the thing about a woman's right to her body and to choose and so forth is that's a very interesting thing to consider. I mean, there's a lot of shouting back and forth about, you know, subjects like abortion versus a woman's right to choose. But the real, the fundamental issue they're making is, at what point, if a woman has a fetus growing within her, or, you know, a new person growing within her, mm-hmm. at what point is that not part of her body, but a different body?
Exactly. And she gives up that right at some point. Even, you know, pro-abortion folks say there's a certain place that being, from a set of cells to a, you know, a little stubby thing to like a human being, there's a certain point at which that the woman's right to end that being is declining, right? At when the being is first installed in her body, she has full rights, and then at some point that being's rights are growing, and there's an arbitrary, kind of somewhat arbitrary, but there's a place in which those two rights intersect, and now she loses the right to end that being's life. Even in our pro-abortion, like where we've had abortion laws, it wasn't a full right. You can't kill a 9-month-old fetus.
Right.
That again is a way of simplifying the argument. When in fact there's a real argument there, which is to say that there's these two competing rights, of which I believe the female should have absolute right from the very beginning, and then declining rights at some point at which we say, okay. And we're going to arbitrarily make an arbitrary decision, but there are no rights after that. That now falls into the society has to safeguard that individual's right, the being that can't speak for itself. So again, in these, if we simplify, then we end up with the kind of no one's talking to each other situation. But in reality, we end up with kind of, you know, something that bridges the gap between those two.
Yeah, and I think that's a really tough one, because you have some people who are very vocal and assert themselves very strongly, and they believe that at the moment of conception, that is a separate life. So abortion is not okay at any time along that, from that point on.
Right.
And they
can hold that.
Yeah, I mean, a rational scientific view would tell you, no, that's not really correct. I mean,
right. But as we said earlier, it's like everybody has the right to hold completely wrong models in their head about everything. I mean, and that's just the question is
whether they can impose those models on others.
Well, if they're able to use the democratic process to convince enough people, because again, democratic rights are all negotiated. That's just the bottom line. There are no rights out there. All rights are inventions of human beings that we agree over time that that's a right, and you have this right, and they have this right. And so the repeated application of the process of the democratic rights making is really about where the society is. 100 years ago, the society didn't believe women had the right to vote. Just about 100 years, 100 something, right? So it didn't believe that was a right. And then enough women, and in fact, many women fought against the right to vote. This is what's like missed in all of these historical stories. Oh, then women got the right. Everybody supported it. No, there was that one guy whose mom sent him a letter, and he was going to say no. And his mom said, please support this. And he got the letter in time, and he said yes. And women got the right to vote. I mean, it wasn't like some kind of like the whole society got a, you know, and women are still fighting against women's right to vote and to participate in the economy. Women fight.
Right. Yeah.
So they get to hold those beliefs. And that's what I think is really difficult, is we have to allow people to have their beliefs. We then have to try to convince them or educate them or show them some facts, you know, and all of these things to be able to come to our side. But ultimately, yeah, there's someone gets to believe that the right of the zygote is a right. Okay. That's your belief. Now we have to fight it out in the democratic process.
And, you know, the democratic process shouldn't be simply majoritarian, but it also should not. We shouldn't have a situation where minority rules either. We need to figure out how to have a conversation that leads to a meaningful consensus. And I don't think that we have that at all right now.
Well, we have the best system by which that can occur. And what I mean by that is, if you study the history of, like, you know, Greek democracy or authoritarian, right? So All of us should agree, I think, and if we don't, then we're really back in a whole other conversation, that we prefer a democratic process to an authoritarian process. Because in the authoritarian process, if I'm king, it's all well and good. But if you come and kill me, and you become king, now it sucks for me, right? So that logic is how humans organize their affairs for thousands of years. And the invention of democracy, which is a very new, the final implementation of a real working democracy. Greece was not a working democracy, because they didn't understand that you have to divide this process into four steps. The great invention of the American democratic method, which is now used across constitutions and everywhere, is that you have a legislature, you have the polity that has the right to speak their voice. Then you have a legislature, some kind of legislative body that gets to make laws. Then you have an executive body that gets to ratify those laws. And then you have a judicial body, independent of all these bodies are independent, that gets to say, hey, do we think that law is constitutional or not? And that cycle can go many, many times. So, you know, that's how it works. Does it work perfectly? No. Is it the best we've got and we can probably imagine? Absolutely, right? Short of everybody votes every single day of their lives for every single issue and we do it that way. So this kind of system of separating these things out is a fundamental, I consider that the second great invention of human existence, is this idea that we have to have a process, imperfect as it is, where we can, you know, continue to negotiate these rights.
Yeah, I think some people haven't realized how close we came to not having a democracy. We were very much on the verge of an authoritarian government, and we basically escaped by the skin of our teeth.
Maybe,
because there are still people who deny, you know, the existence of a democracy. They want to have an authoritarian, you know, one guy rules us all, and we know who that guy is.
Their guy. And that's the thing that the Rome got plagued with the Caesars and the emperors, and every society has that because we're monkeys. At the end of the day, we're little monkeys that want a big monkey to tell us what to do. And that's sort of our big problem, right? That's back to the primal brain, right? The primal brain says, oh, that guy's in charge, so we'll all just fall in line. But the developed brain says, no, we have to engage in this process, right? And that's where I think we're failing. We're failing because we're not teaching people where these processes come from, how amazingly hard it was to create these processes of science and democracy and entrepreneurship and capitalism, and why they all are the greatest asset that we have for which to move forward and build our societies.
And I think we've always had times where we sort of moved away from those processes and lost our way, and then we found our way back, and hopefully we will again.
The processes are very young. That's sort of the point, right? The scientific method was invented by Galileo in the 1600s, and then by the Royal Society. It took about 100 years, the late 1600s. That's very young. The democratic method was 1776 to 1803, and very few, I mean, countries are, you know, doing that. So oh, there you go.
We have reached the end of the internet.
You mean we have no more reality to be real about?
Yeah, no more reality to be real about.
That's okay.
So
I'm perfectly happy being a hairless ape. And
well, that's a great conversation there, Bijoy, that we just had.
Yeah, it's great.
I wish we had more time. So you will come back, I hope.
Look forward to it.
Please.
All right. Well, I will see you both soon.
Later. You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.